In this episode of The Critical Myth, the Critical Myth crew comes out of the shadows with Covert Affairs, gets timey-wimey with Continuum, takes a hard left turn with Falling Skies, and explores the changes of Defiance. It's episode 464, Gary Gets Redacted.
That's right, this is episode 464 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I wish I could check in at work by just staring at a security camera. Oh, wait a minute, maybe I can.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm just glad to have some old friends back on the tube again. I guess it's not a tube anymore, but you know what I mean.
Yes, some old friends on that collection of pixels. What can I say? I can't disagree. Although in some cases I feel like some of those old friends should have perhaps gone out to pasture before they bothered to come back. That being said, we're definitely going to be getting into a lot of shows. And wow, I mean, we're at that point now where the summer season is definitely well in earnest. We have a lot of shows that are either debuting their summer seasons or debuting in general. I think this is probably the summer where we have more shows that are actually starting. Debuting in the summer than we've had in a long time, at least genre material, but I guess we'll get into that more as we go. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of a disclaimer here?
We will discuss just about anything that might have happened on these shows. That is our firm and absolute policy. So it means that if you haven't seen them, we're probably going to spoil them for you. I know it's getting busier and more crowded out there, so we try and leave at least a week or so before we do that to you.
That's right. And, I think I know where we're going to start here, but I might as well just tempt fate and ask the question. Gary, what would you like to start with? Hello?
Oh, sorry, I was being redacted. Anyway, yeah, we have clearance to go into the CIA and talk about Covert Affairs.
All right, and we have a couple episodes to talk about here, so let's go ahead and run the promo for Season 5 first.
4 months off the grid, suddenly she wants to meet.
On the season premiere of Covert Affairs, Annie returns.
You want to tell me what happened the last 4 months?
You can trust me.
And an outside threat.
The attack in Chicago.
It's going to happen today.
We have a real and credible threat.
Could be an inside conspiracy.
One of the most dangerous terrorists.
Somehow had knowledge of our secret CIA facility.
Covert Affairs. New season premieres Tuesday at 10. Only on USA.
All right, and Gary, if you could do the honors.
Absolutely. We're talking about Covert Affairs, Season 5, Episode 1. The Season 5 opener finds Annie and Augie thinking about the future, just as a connection from the past resurfaces and leads Annie on a race against time to prevent a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. Elsewhere, tension mounts between Calder and Joan as they wait to see who will become the new boss, and Arthur thinks about a career in the private sector.
Okay, and what would you give this one, do you think, Gary?
I would give this one a 9.
All right. And Edmund, how about you?
I will go 8.5.
All right. And I gave this one an 8. All right. So not a bad beginning. But Gary, I figure you've been waiting long enough to actually talk about this. So why don't you go ahead and weigh in on your first impressions?
I liked it. I liked that there was a gap between the end of season 4 and the beginning of season 5, about 3 to 4 months, if I recall what the story stated. And during that time, the CIA had somewhat intermittent contact with Annie, but she was staying so far off the grid, even when they found her, she lost them again. So I thought that was nice. But there is this mystery about what happened in that time. Where did she go? What did she do? More importantly, what's wrong with Annie? Why is she having panic attacks? Why does she need this medicine injected into her after that chase? I'm really concerned and worried for her. That being said, the cooling off, or I guess end of the Annie-Augie relationship was also presented to us, and Augie seemed oddly okay with it. I was a little surprised. I thought there'd be a little bit more pushback from that, but there wasn't. Then we go back, I guess, you know, while we didn't see the baby, Joan is back at work, and Calder and her are both vying for the same job that Calder ends up getting. Not surprising, given the whole situation that happened with Arthur last season. And then Arthur, Arthur's up to something. I still think he is. We're introduced to a new character. His last name's Quaid. And from what I understand, Arthur was his teacher at the academy, the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And that's how they met each other. Now, Quaid is this big mercenary for hire, kind of Blackwater or whatever they're calling themselves now. Type of guy, and Arthur goes to get a job for him. It doesn't seem quite like quite what Arthur would be doing, but I think it's a plot point that will probably develop over the course of the season. That being said, we see Annie once again, never quite fully debriefed. I think this is the third or fourth time we've seen the CIA start to debrief her, and then something comes up and she's pulled away. And her sort of storyline starts again with hunting down the terrorist that we were partially left with at the end of last season that was never fully resolved. So, and then he gets killed and we find out the stakes are raised even high, even for a covert affair. So, I think they did a good job of bringing Annie back, throwing in some mystery, reintroducing us back to some of the supporting characters and giving them some tensions, as well as, ending the Annie's relationship and sort of putting her, right back to work where she says, her head needs to be. So I thought they did a good job of putting everything in motion.
Mm. Edmund, what would you add to that, do you think?
Expanding a bit on sort of that main plot point. I thought that even though it is a plot device, they do seem to lean on a bit of when Annie's brought in and then it all gets interrupted because she's the only one who can go meet with this guy and try and figure out what terrorist plot is going on. I thought it did work well in this instance, and I also liked the way they played with some of the conventions of. When he's shot by the sniper, when it's just when it seems he's about to reveal something, and he's implying that there's darker forces at work that are operating within the government possibly, and then the Chicago section chief just gives that order to fire and take him out because Annie was in danger and he wanted to make sure he protected her, which seemed a little suspicious and seemed to be setting up or is I'm sure possibly. Still setting up one of the plot points that will be coming up, but then to segue from that into tracking down this family and having it be this very intricate plot to take out that very section, and take out their secret offices in Chicago was a very nice job of ramping up the tension and introducing this new avenues to follow, especially after as John was bringing up in the wrap up episode last time, after they'd gotten rid of Henry Wilcox and really wiped the slate as far as villains and the stuff they've been fighting against. So I thought they did do a very good job of starting up these new threads and certainly doing a literally explosive opening. And at the same time giving us enough of where everybody's at to get ourselves situated in these new circumstances so I thought it was a very good return and a very good way to introduce the new things they want to play around with this season and I will just mention I think Gary did forget to mention the name of the episode is Shady Lane because unfortunately this is not a group that I'm that familiar with their output, but apparently we're doing Pavement song titles this year.
You beat me to it because I was going to bring it up before we got too far out of it, but yes, talk about going from somewhat well-known artist to something a little obscure, but it should make for some very interesting titles this season for the episodes. So going back to what we were saying in our previous show about concerns coming out of season 4 and into season 5, I would agree that this is a nice start because it's a time jump, but not a huge one. So yes, there are things that still need to be resolved in terms of, where was Annie? What was she up to? Why is she so, what is this condition that she's dealing with? How is she really dealing or not dealing with what happened with Henry Wilcox? Why is she on the outs with Augie? All of these things kind of are now in play, but they're not all dominating the episode because there's other stuff that needs to be dealt with. But coming out of that then, okay, and having to reestablish where the show is going from here, how successfully do you feel like they did that with this episode? Gary, I doubt that it was going to take very much to to get on your good side for the, when it comes to this show, but what are your thoughts on that?
I might be a little biased more than anyone else because I do enjoy the show so much, but no, I usually pull it off pretty well, so I can't complain that it was lacking.
Mm. Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, no, I'm pleasantly intrigued with what they're setting up. So yeah, no, I was good with the little hints and place markers they were putting out.
Okay.
Although, just as one little side note, the only thing I could think of when they said Quaid was, I kept thinking of, you know, get to Mars. But anyway, so other than that,
I think it is actually McQuaid.
I was going to let Gary figure that out on his own when he read the next recap. Well, that's okay.
Yes.
Speaking of, let's go ahead then and run the promo for the next episode before we have Gary do that reading.
This is a direct attack, and we will not stop until we bring the people who did this to justice.
Where's Bors now?
Bors Alten remains in the wind. Find him.
This guy is dangerous. Need him alive.
We need him caught.
What the hell are you doing?
Covert Affairs, an all-new episode Tuesday at 10 on USA.
All right, and Gary, if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about Covert Affairs, Season 5, Episode 2, False Scorpion. Annie may have to work with Ryan McQuaid to capture a terrorist. Elsewhere, Augie is questioned by the NCTC regarding a threat facing the intelligence community. Dum-dum-dum.
Mm-hmm. And what would you give this one, do you think?
I would give this one an 8.
All right. And Edmund?
I think I'm good with an 8 as well.
And I also gave it an 8, so there we go. 8s all around. All right. So, Gary, once again, get us started off here. And maybe what was the difference for you between this and the previous episode where you gave it a 9?
They had been doing so well with this, but I really had this sense that Annie was incompetence too strong, but less competent a agent. She was, you know, doing some successful things, but at the same time, it just didn't seem like she was back on her game, I guess might be the way to put it. McQuaid and his group, while yes, there were more of them, you know, seemed to be, you know, running all over her her operation, and whatever she did, they could do better. For a while, we'd complained that they had portrayed her as a sort of incompetent person who either needed, you know, help from Augie or, you know, Ayal or someone else. But towards the end of towards last season, she was doing a lot of stuff on her own and successfully. But this sort of slip back to need someone else's help to achieve her objective because she can't do it, it just seems a little bit out of the mold. In real life, I'm sure it happens, but it just makes her seem like the girl stumbling and falling while she's running against the villain. It just didn't. It felt a little uncomfortable or forced that she was less competent.
Mm. Interesting. Edmund, what do you agree, disagree?
Yeah, that bothered me a bit too. And although, as Gary was mentioning it, I was realizing that with the stuff that's going on now that we did get the apparently, I don't know why she would lie to the doctor, except it was in front of McQuaid, but that apparently this is a heart condition that's causing her to have these attacks. And I'm still not completely convinced on that. I think she may have been trying to hide something, because it does seem as much psychological as physical. And that there may have been a sense of they're trying to set things up for whatever reason, with what happened in these 4 months, Annie is less trusting and less doesn't want to reach out to the support system that she would normally have, and as much, and this whole thing about not bringing McQuaid's group in when Calder is basically tells her to do it, and why didn't she read the men on this? They might be trying to set up something where that's a symptom of some of the ramifications of what she's been up to and what's happened, but they didn't do a very good job of presenting it. It really did come off as Annie just being stubborn and doing things that were not in her best interest again, which was a little bit too much of a backslide.
Yeah, I don't know that I really took it as a backslide, though, because in some cases throughout the entire struggle, I thought that it was perfectly fine what she was doing in terms of dealing with the situation. I'm still feeling like she's thrown off by what she's experienced since she was last seen. And the fact that she's basically, you know, having to resurrect her career, if not herself, in a certain legal sense. But I don't know. Some of the things I felt were just her getting outmatched a little bit by McQuaid because she was underestimating him. And I'm not sure that that's altogether a bad assumption on her part, because I definitely agree with the idea that Arthur is playing a long game, because there's definitely more to McQuaid than meets the eye, and I think even he knows more about it than he's telling anybody. I feel like even Joan knows a bit about it, because when they were talking about McQuaid and where, you know, Arthur stood, and that she, you know, he had dinner with the number two who was trying to seduce him, and Joan's reaction was completely different than what I was expecting, which was more of the, huh, good. And then they clinked the wine glasses, and it's like, okay.
Exactly. Something's running.
Yeah, exactly. They have some longer con or play in mind. And so I'm wondering if I know that I like to read into the show a lot more than I do, but or than I should. But last season was probably the first time that it actually paid off.
So now you're encouraged. Yes.
Yes, that's right. Now I'm encouraged. But the but now we've got a lot of reasons to think that Annie was kind of put into a position where she was a little bit back on her put back on her heels, and she still did, I thought, well enough under the circumstances. Particularly when she was playing the cop in order to get out of trouble. And I thought it was particularly hilarious that she plays this completely clueless young, you know, fiance. Oh, I had to come here to get plastic surgery because my boyfriend wants it. And the guy's just, like, flustered completely.
And he's going to come out afterwards.
Yeah.
Yes. When he can get off work. I did also wonder if that was, especially now that Piper Perabo's a producer on the show, if that was her own little tongue-in-cheek jab at the industry about who earlier in her career said she should have a boob job, and she's getting back at them now.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's see. What else do we want to say about this episode? Other than the fact that it's a little creepy or weird that Augie is getting it on with the Pink Ranger. But anyway.
Jealous, John.
I'm sure that there are people that are jealous of Augie, but I was just a little like, I felt a little old. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's maybe it's just because I, in particular, feel like Annie Augie was a good direction for them to go, and I feel like maybe a bit of my reserved scoring so far in these first two episodes is partially because I feel like they're putting obstacles in between them again, and I feel like it's just another holding action before they get back together. And I don't know, there was a lot of weird relationship stuff going on, and I really hope that they're not trying to set up Annie and McQuaid other than as friendly adversaries, because that would be quite irritating. But
I already feel irritated.
Yeah, he's a little smarmy. But it probably doesn't help that he reminds me of the guy who's playing the lead on The Last Ship, who was also one of the leads on Grey's Anatomy. And I know it's not the same actor, but
I know,
he's so reminiscent, and it just, I keep feeling like, But it puts me off a little bit. But at any rate, still a good, strong beginning, I think, to this season. And certainly, as we know from last time, around an 8 is what the show now has as its current bar to either maintain or exceed. So it's not a bad start. And certainly there's a little bit of room to maneuver from here. All right, well, let's go ahead then and pick our next topic. And Edmund, if you could do... Well, okay, I guess... I'm sorry, Gary. I really did like it. Just joking.
I didn't even bring up hair color, so just let's move on.
Well, it changed so much, so. Anyway, Edmund, our next topic, if you will.
I think I'd like to go from a premiere all the way to a finale and talk about that last episode of Continuum.
Oh, boy. Okay, and let's go ahead and run the promo.
On the season finale of Continuum.
Once there was a boy who lived on the farm.
Alec launches Halo. It changes everything.
That boy had a dream that nobody believed in.
Tomorrow you'll become the next Steve Jobs.
You wanted to make a difference. You do this and you never get back home to your future. Your family. I am that boy. And Halo is that dream.
This timeline isn't big enough for both of us.
Continuum. Season finale next Sunday at 9, exclusively on Showcase.
All right, and if you could do the honors.
Certainly. This is Continuum Season 3, Episode 13, Last Minute. In the Season 3 finale, Kira and Liberate find themselves in an unlikely alliance as they work together to stop a power-hungry Alec from unleashing his dangerous new technology. At the same time, Kira's relationship with John Doe appears to be doomed as forces push them to opposing sides in a larger conflict. Meanwhile, Scar Alec comes to learn that Kellogg has been making his own game-changing moves.
Hmm. Yeah. All right, well, what would you give this one, do you think?
I would give this a 7.5.
All right, and Gary, how about you?
I'll go with a 7.
7, okay. I would go with an 8, so... All right. Well, Edmund, why a 7.5?
The man in the middle?
Yeah.
The main things for me was in terms of after doing some, I thought, rather thought-provoking stuff, particularly with that episode-ending showdown a couple of episodes before, and some of the things they had been setting up then with the attack on the freelancers. There was my main issues with this finale was there were a couple of relationship things that just felt off and felt like they hadn't really been properly developed in the season. First was Kira and they called him John Doe in the summary, which annoys me because he does have a name, but I can't remember it.
Brad, I believe.
He had been identified at this point. But the two of them now being so cozy in the cabin, and just knowing their histories, I get the sort of camaraderie of stranded time travelers. But I don't think they did a very good job in those episodes from earlier in the season when he was sleeping on her couch, and I did get a sort of sense that they were trying to develop the relationship, but they never really did a very good job of it. So then having them sort of so completely together in this episode just felt strange. And then the final showdowns between the two Alecs, again didn't feel that they'd really done enough to develop the characters in the way that they were now throwing down with each other, and especially with Pyron Alec and that whole product launch where he's coming off as some mix of I guess more Mark Zuckerberg in looks, but Steve Jobs in terms of the adulation he seems to suddenly have, and that was all being thrown in just to show how powerful he is and we have to stop him. There are other things, but those were the two elements that were really not ringing true to me in this. But what did you guys think about that?
I agree. Alex literally taking pot shots at the other Alex. Really, I didn't see that jump in development that hatred would have gone that far that he would try to kill him. That seemed a little bit out of a stretch, and a lot of things seemed out of stretch in this episode for me. But John, did you see that? Did you see the sudden flare up between Alex on Alex hatred as foreshadowed?
There's not enough room in this timeline for the both of us. My main issue, and I still like the episode quite a bit, but I think maybe it's more for the potential that it created than for its actual execution, because my main complaint for the season was the fact that the time travel, time continuum theoretical timey-wimey-ness was very complicated. And I don't feel like they really did the best job of explaining the nuances that they were trying to play with. Certainly, they kind of lost their way or got a little too complex about halfway in, and it went from being a fringe-esque matter of debate to a just mishmash of I don't even know what. And then they come to this finale, and the battle lines are suddenly drawn very distinctly. It's all simplified to the point, and it's done to a point where they almost present it as though anybody watching it should have known that this is what it was going to boil down to. And I don't feel like that was really the case. I feel like they simplified it for the sake of the finale, and really expected the audience to kind of go back and fill in some of the blanks later. which isn't necessarily a huge problem because, I mean, there are shows that really beg you to do that. But I don't know that this season was begging you to do that. I feel like a part of me wanted to go back and see how it all added up. And then a part of me just said, you know what? I'm good where they're at. And I'll just be happy to see what they do in the fourth season and let it go.
I would say I'd agree. And in my case, part of me was scared that if I go back, I'm not going to see the threads because I'm not sure they're there.
Yeah, well, that's the other problem too, right? And I guess, you know, another part that was slightly odd to me was that there are obvious shades of the Terminator in this finale with, you know, there's this future time where Kellogg is kind of has this big plan. I know that it's almost a take on a darker take on what older Alec did in general in the first season. But then there's this whole thing of, okay, there's this apocalyptic future and this guy gets sent back ostensibly to prevent it by eliminating all the other time travelers and so on. And I'm still not even clear entirely on what his plan was because, I don't know. And well, then we have these people show up at the end that are from the future. I don't know if Brad recognized them as their adversaries in the future. That was kind of what I was reading into it. But at the same time, if some guys in some mechanized armored suits with weapons in their hands came and popped out of nowhere, I think I'd just say run too. Even if I didn't know who they were. You were going to jump in there with something, Gary?
Oh, well, I was going to say, I was thinking about the whole Kellogg angle, and remember, keep in mind that if we go way back, you know, it was SatTech versus Pyron. That was named as the other big corporation. So, you know, maybe we're not as far off the original timeline as we're thinking. If, you know, Kellogg's in charge of Pyron and then Alex in SatTech is sort of, you know, keeping him in check, you know, through his corporation. And maybe that is the conflict that we started off with.
Well, I think that, you know, that's all cool, except for that it wasn't one of the big issues that basically this whole business of Alec going back a week in time to save Emily essentially precipitated the destruction of the future that Kira and the Liberate people came from. That future no longer exists.
Well, that's what I was reading into it anyway. The argument was that they don't know what future is going to exist.
Right. Well, yeah, that's part of it too. That's what I mean, is that they kind of got to the point where they said everything's up for grabs, largely because you had too many people dipping into the same time, well, in time, I guess you could say, and now everything is the cause and effect that made it more of a time loop has now been completely blown out of the water, but that's part of the confusion. And that's part of where I think they maybe got a little too cute with the time travel stuff. I think it was perfectly fine when they were in more of a loop. They were throwing complications into everything, and that was fine. And I was kind of happy with where the story was before. I think it got a little ambitious here, and they're taking the show into a direction that, while I'm still very much interested in it, I feel like there's the potential for them to kind of go down the wrong path. And I'm a little wary of that. What do you guys think? Edmund, how about you?
I certainly agree. I got the similar sense that it did seem to be about halfway through the season that these different time streams and time loops they were setting up started to lose their coherence. It was an odd thing where it felt like things were not necessarily starting to resolve, but I was interested in where they were putting the characters, But it was a case of more with these characters and that they've created over these three seasons. I was intrigued with the way they were then all reacting to this rather amorphous concept of we can't really shape the future as much as we were thinking, and how they're going to react to that, and then to go take a sharp turn back in the finale. It's actually kind of reminding me that other Canadian show Charlie Jade, where it started off one way that was a little more amorphous, and then they tightened the story up about halfway through. And in this case, though, it was all happening in one episode. And it's a case of I did give it the 7.5. I did enjoy it, but had these reservations that about how much they actually do have control of their own story now. And of course, it's still up in the air whether or not it's coming back, which is another thing that's worrying me. But even though I keep seeing all these posts about, oh no, this is just how Showcase hammers down salary demands by putting all the actors on the spot, which is not a very helpful tactic for the actors. But so I do hope it is coming back, because I do want to see if they can perhaps make a little more sense out of things than they did by the end here.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's go ahead and take our mid-show break, and then we'll come back with Gary's next choice, so stay tuned. All right, and boy, we've had some heady conversation so far and content, so let's see where we go from here. Gary, why don't you go ahead and give us some direction?
Gosh, that makes us sound so productive that I think I want to derail this whole operation as far as talking about worth of shows and switch over to Falling Skies.
Oh, yeah, that's one way to do it. All right, and... Well, I don't think I'm going to bother with the promos here, since this is technically a show that we don't really... Well, you know what? Might as well. Here's the promo for the fourth season.
Gentlemen, it's been an honor and a privilege serving with you!
We've been through so much. We survived so many battles.
Son of a...
They've countered us out every time. But we've endured and won. Now, abandoned.
Countermeasures!
Separated. And alone.
Dad! Run!
Everything's changed.
There is no more us. We fail.
Everyone has family that they're trying to find.
These are all...
What the hell are they?
When all is lost, let the moon be your guide.
right, Gary, and if you could do the recap.
Sure, we're talking about Falling Skies, Season 4. Wow. Anyway, Episode 1, Season 4 begins with the Masons and Second Mass under brutal attack by the new Isfani war machine and a medicine creation. Before long, the Masons must each establish new relationships and survival techniques.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's see here. What would you give this premiere, do you think?
Six.
Okay. And, Edmund, did you happen to watch this?
Yes, I did.
We were all glad.
I'll go with the six as well.
I'm going to go with a 7.5.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why did you go with a 7.5, John? What was the redeeming thing that I did not see that so enraptured you?
I don't know that it was necessarily that redeeming. So much as I was anticipating one thing out of this particular season premiere, and it gave me something very different. And some of the things I thought were clever. I liked the idea that this whole, you know, they set up this idea that in the third season finale that the real problem was going to be between the humans and the Volm, the people that they introduced in the third season, and that the Isfani were completely out of the picture, and then they come back and it's completely not that way at all, which I thought was a nice way of completely going against expectation. Also, not completely surprising, considering that the showrunner was replaced in between the third and fourth season, and now the person running the show is David Icke, a name that may be familiar to people who are fans of the rebooted version of Battlestar Galactica. So what I see here is an attempt to essentially reboot the series to a certain extent and give it a bit more of an edge. And the stuff that was going on in the concentration camp, that's not really a concentration camp, was different and unexpected.
A ghetto,
yeah. I thought that was interesting. As much as it was beating you over the head with a brick, I thought that the stuff in the re-education camp was interesting, in that all the Nazi stuff aside, I was intrigued as to what it is that they're actually trying to accomplish. Less intriguing was the whole idea of, what's her name? The girl, Lexi, is it?
Yes.
Okay. I think we all knew, coming out of the third season finale, that the idea of this hybrid child was a complete and utter disaster. I
prefer the term star child.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Edmund might get it, too, Ken.
Yeah, well, yeah, we all get it. Talk about Nazi allegories, but anyway, but then I don't know, I felt like they at least did something that was about as good as it was going to be for this, and it left me almost as disquieted as the whole idea of a re-education camp. So I don't know, I think that there are good concepts here. The execution is still perhaps much to be desired, but I don't know. I was entertained and intrigued. Now, clearly you two were not as entertained or intrigued. So, Gary, what would your rebuttal be, I guess?
Well, I do have to say that I felt the Nazi-ish overtones were more than overtones. They were pretty much slaps in your faces. Could we have at least had that lead kid not have been so Aryan looking, or not had an exact Hitler youth haircut? I mean, did they really have to sort of put it and take it, show it to us, and then smush it in our faces? I thought it was a little over the top, a little too much. You know, I don't need to be force fed quite that much to get the idea. The uniforms would have been sufficient. That being said, I enjoyed the beginning when Tom was, you know, in solitary and trying to handle that and get a hold of things. I thought it was going well. Then as they sort of started to have the, what I had assumed were something like flashbacks or flash forwards, I was trying to understand that until we understood later at the end that it was actually one and the same. It was one and the same, which I didn't think. I thought it was nice. I thought it was nice how they showed the people, as you said, in the ghetto, sort of trying to make do and get along and all the troubles that come along with that. Again, a little bit too, much more Nazi overtones for me. And then we had the whole thing with Lexi that I just didn't, I still don't quite get, but it just seemed like a real stretch for me. And as far as them changing complete tactics that they had used for 3 to 4 years, and we had this sense that this is the same thing they had done on every single planet, seemed very odd. I was waiting for an explanation that we never quite got. Then we even got a new alien that, even though we've been fighting for, I think, 3 or 4 years, we never really saw that much before. So that was another thing that sort of struck me off guard. And it was just, maybe it was the confusion, but as you said, John, a new showrunner took over and he's done like a hard 180 on this show. It's very different for the most part. And I wasn't ready for it, and I don't felt like I got any explanation explaining the change. So.
Okay. I would agree with that. I feel like it was definitely a, we're going to fix this show, or at least that was the impression that I got, was that that's what they felt they were doing, is that we're going to fix this, and we're not even going to bother trying to make it align with what was going on before in anything more than the most basic, general way. We're just going to move on, kind of idea. How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, I feel very much the same way as Gary. I wasn't aware of the behind the scenes stuff for once. That was because the end of the previous season left me so underwhelmed that I wasn't really following it. Having them come back, and what got to me more about, I understand shifting a show's focus and jumping ahead and then going back and showing you how they got to this new point. But it just seemed like it was throwing too many new ideas at the wall. It was having the ghetto and the re-education camp and Lexi's, whatever Lexi's group is. It was a case of just throwing too much out there. And especially the way the show is sort of... careened from different methods and different plots and introducing the Vohm last season, it just felt to me more like a show that's been that was flailing about and trying to come up with some sort of idea to bring it back, but it didn't feel very cohesive in the way they were doing that. So it was, yeah, it was, so this wasn't a case of being so invested in where they were at, but having such a complete disconnect from where they were at was just way more confusing than it needed to be, I think.
Hmm. All right. Well, I think that covers the premiere. Why don't we go ahead then and talk about the next episode? And here's the promo.
Your games have come to an end.
The new season of Falling Skies is just getting started.
Don't make me defy you.
Lexi! Lexi!
You want me? Here I am!
We are creating a new frontline army.
The new power source would allow the Ashveni to go on offense.
The overlord from the ghetto.
This guy's not gonna rest till he wipes off the face of the earth.
The apocalypse has been the best thing that ever happened to me.
I feel drawn to you.
In this season, the battle for humanity.
That is the enemy!
For hope. For the planet.
Come on!
Will leave Earth behind. Falling Skies, all new Sundays at 10 on TNT.
And Gary, if you could do the recap for this one, too.
Sure. We're talking about Falling Skies, Season 4, Episode 2, The Eye. Tom faces an impossible decision when the Isfani plan is revealed to him. Meanwhile, Weaver and Pope seek to the great escape from the Isfani prison. Matt tries to hide his true allegiance, and Anne searches for her daughter.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
5.
All right, and Edmund?
I will stick with my 6.
All right, and this one I would give a 6.5. Gary?
Yes?
Why a 5?
How the heck did Tom get off of yet another alien ship unharmed?
Oh, wow. You know, I was really kind of hoping you did not notice that. That was me being the writer's room. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, well, let's see. Well, they did say he made an agreement, but after all the threats of bring the ghost to me or else, you know, and then they bring him and then nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And then they conveniently leave, have power schematics running in the room he's in. And that seems a little odd, but we did get a little exposition while we were on the ship. So that sort of, that explains the or at least hinted as to why we have now have the re-education camps, that the bonding to the children, I guess, wasn't working quite as it was the way they expected or it had in the past. So now that they were pursuing a different method, then for ways that I do not even understand and they really did not explain to me, the hope of the Isfahani is now in the hybrid, which is Lexi, who is now looks 21, even though she's 1 year old. And she can do all sorts of funny things like make wind blow and stop mechs by electrocuting them, even though we didn't get to see it. So it's more show reset, obviously, but I just had to wonder what the heck was, you know, where the heck this was going on. And while we didn't mention it last season, where did all these gates come from all of a sudden with all these laser fences? Shouldn't they have been using these way earlier? Like, wouldn't that have helped when they were building that other thing, you know, in season two? Anyway,
let's not even think about it might have been a good thing to protect the tower in at the end of season three that they just sailed up the river towards, but anyway.
Also the marginalization of the, is it Vom? Sounds like conjugation class. Anyway, of the Vom now, besides not coming with any large show of force, is left to a few ragtag guerrilla teams that are combing the planet for just to keep information flowing in. Then we find out, you know, that power source they were building last time? Oh, yeah. Well, that was just defensive. Now they've decided to build an offensive one instead. Oh, boy. Well, we'll have to deal with that later. I'm sure we will. Anyway, again, it was extremely exposition heavy. It was a hard twist without much reasoning for it, and just a lot of holes. And then, oh, that was right. Who was it? Anne, when she was questioning the Skitter. If you tell me, I'll keep you alive. Obviously, she lies a lot because she did it. And so that was another sort of thing that I found is odd. It is nice that the old ex-harnessed children can still translate, though. So that's one thing they haven't retconned the way yet.
Edmund, how about you?
No, well, Gary's actually hit most of the points. Although I will admit that there are some characters, or I should say more actors, who do hold my interest. And if they want to do a spin-off with just Weaver and Pope, I'd be more than happy to watch that.
The two
of them butting heads in the ghetto was probably pretty much my highlight in this episode. So.
Yes, the Weaver and Pope show. There you go. The Odd Couple goes on the road in the apocalypse. Yay! All right. So let's see. Let's go ahead then and move on to a different show. I'm just going to say that because of the fact that Falling Skies is at least trying to get into a better place. I'm hoping that they can kind of bounce out of this early season kind of difficulties. But let's keep in mind that the show was not exactly knocking it out of the park before. So it's not necessarily right now any worse than it was last season. It's just it maybe needs to do a little bit of work in order to make the improvements that it's trying to establish here. Edmund, what shall we discuss next?
So let's move on to another show that's incorporating some changes and talk about Defiance.
All right. And let's go ahead and run the second season promo then.
This world is an abomination. It's because of you, humans.
We can do it the easy way or we can do it the hard way. Your choice.
Let us be strong.
I think it's time we take back our town.
Defiance premieres Thursday, June 19th at 8, only on Sci-Fi.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. This is Defiance Season 2, Episode 1, The Opposite of Hallelujah. In the Season 2 premiere, Nolan's search for Arissa leads him to New Chicago and Angel Ark, Los Angeles. Meanwhile, back in Defiance, the Earth Republic appoints a charming, calculating, ambitious man named Niles Pottinger as mayor.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I will give this an 8.
All right, and that's also what I gave it. I know that Gary hasn't been able to catch up with this show quite yet, so if we can be at least relatively light on the spoilers, I guess. But it's not a whole lot of surprises here. I think you can read between the lines on a lot of the stuff that's in the promos. So I guess for me, what I really liked about this premiere in particular was the fact that they weren't afraid to roam out in new areas of the world, both in terms of actually geographically and also narratively, back in Defiance. They didn't try and soft sell what they had done in the finale last season. They really, instead of telling you what that was supposed to be all about, they actually just went ahead and showed you what it was all about. So I felt like the exposition was somewhat minor compared to what they had done for, in terms of the number of changes that they had introduced. How about you?
Yeah, definitely. And also a very classic case of showing you, not telling you, and just expecting or allowing the audience to catch up as they went along, with the Earth rep invasion, occupation, whatever you want to call it, and of course Datek's little loss of control at the end of last season had the major ramifications you would expect, and with Nolan's search for Arisa there it did amuse me that this does seem to be now a trope of sci-fi shows, or at least between for Defiance and Warehouse 13, where you can go across vast sections of the country but you never talk about how long it took you to get there. So
yes,
you know, you never saw Pete and Micah in an airport, and Nolan can go from Chicago to Los Angeles to St. Louis, and in a roller, but there's no talk of the road trip or the cross country aspect of it, so which is fine in terms of just, you know, driving the plot along and getting us getting us to where we need to go narrative wise, but it still amused me that that was coming up again.
I guess for me, there are a lot of changes that are going on here, but I guess the best part about it is that, again, they're following through with all the things that they introduced at the end of last season, and they're not trying to resolve it all at once. They're letting the consequences spill out, as they should. One thing that I thought was interesting is that Kenya has yet to be found.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And the stuff with Arisa is still not clear to me, at least at this stage of the game. But it definitely seems like she's changed. And I don't know if it's because they're trying to I'm not exactly sure if this is supposed to be meaningful in terms of the show or what, but is it me or does Arisa seem like she looks a little different this season?
I feel
like her hair isn't as raggedy as it was before. It's like she's a little more of the we do have a model turned actress playing the part, so I don't know if they're playing up that or not. But
that did not jump out at me, but that may have been as much because in addition to Jamie Maria's Sama and bathing scenes, we now get Julie Benz running the need one, so I may have been a little distracted.
It's possible. Jamie Murray, who What to say about Stama? Once again, I think that I could say what Bronstone would say, in that Stama feels like a character who thinks she's on Game of Thrones and not a sci-fi show. That's for sure. Between the copious amounts of skin and the machinations along the way. I know that it's either this episode or the next one that we talk about that has one of my favorite scenes. I think it's actually at the beginning of the next episode, where they're in the bath with the son's wife,
who is very
uncomfortable, and she goes to reach for something, and it's like Stama's chest right in the girl's face, and she's just trying not to react at all.
What I also loved about that, because it was the first time you were seeing a regular human sort of in that setting, that doesn't really sink in just quite how white and monochrome that entire scene is until you see this pink person sitting in the bath, is looking completely out of place. But yes, I know we're jumping ahead.
But. Yes, a little bit, but it was a nice, that's a nice visual at least way to once again establish the alienness of what's going on. And is it a little bit of a shortcut to have them just be like, seriously, have this thing about white? Yeah, of course it is. At the same time, it's almost like a time honored trope of science fiction, but I think that it works for them, because the characterization is just so strong, at least from my point of view. Let's see, what else shall we say about the,
Certainly with Pottinger, I mean, just aside from seeing him throwing his weight around, I mean, certainly by the end of the episode, when they certainly did a good job of showing just how completely creepy and the stalkery he was, just to really establish him as the out and out villain and person who we definitely want to see taken down.
That's true. That's very true. Okay, let's go ahead then and do the promo for the second episode.
Aristov's a real pretty name.
Well, good on the arrest report.
If he wants his daughter out of jail, let's make him earn it.
Nobody in this town wants to see me wearing a badge.
This time, he will make things right.
Defiance, all new this Thursday at 8, only on Sci-Fi.
All right, and if you could do the honors.
Certainly. Season 2, Episode 2, In My Secret Life. Arissa is arrested upon her return to Defiance, but Nolan can arrange her release by capturing those responsible for an explosion that nearly killed Mayor Pottinger. Meanwhile, Stama decides the only way to stay in control of her family's criminal enterprises is by ensuring that Daytac stays behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one a 7.
A 7, okay, and I also gave this one an 8, much as I did the premiere. Alright, why would you say that this was more of an average episode than the premiere?
The main thing that brought it down for me was this whole element of Nolan having to be this super detective and tracker, and the case itself wound up being rather pedestrian in terms of you didn't really seem to need Nolan to work this out. It was that was just the plot convenience to keep him in town and trying to win Arissa's release, basically. So that was the main thing that brought it down for me, just as sheer plot mechanics. Because I thought in terms of the further introducing of the new characters, with Berlin, and that whole sort of lovely person of interest esque surveillance that the Earth Republic has introduced to the town was some nice background and world building for this new status quo, I mean, we already mentioned the bathing scene at the beginning, but then also that the whole exchange between Stama and Pottinger, where it just becomes obvious that yes, she is more than happy to keep Daytac behind bars, and also that Pottinger has a taste for Adreno, which is certainly bringing up some interesting possibilities down the line.
Very much so. I would agree with you, even though I really liked the episode. I feel like the whole thing with Nolan and the case was probably the weakest point. It was way too straightforward for this need for this superior tracker that Nolan is supposed to be. It was clearly meant to be just an excuse for why Nolan was going to go back to his old job. And by the way, for all that Tommy was making such a stink out of being replaced, that was pretty easy. But at any rate, I also liked I guess to me it was balanced by the prominence that they were giving the new character of Berlin. And I just kind of like her. Yes, she's definitely antagonistic, But I just think that the character has the potential to be kind of switch teams before the end of the season. Not just because she's with Tommy, but because she seems to be a straight shooter. And she believes in what she's doing right now because she's never been given evidence of why it should be a problem. But I have a feeling that she'll get that evidence before much longer.
I mean, and certainly with the number of skeevy elements they're giving Pottinger, I think when some of his secrets come out, she's not going to feel too much loyalty in that quarter.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, anything else we want to say about this episode?
No, just as opposed to Falling Skies, this definitely Defiance is coming back quite a bit stronger and introducing new elements. But we're not in a case where they were just deliberately trying to rework the show. But it was definitely an example of expanding on what we had in the first season without losing their way.
Hmm.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.